From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am Jerome Bowden, and I would just like to state that my execution is about to be carried out. And I would like to thank the people at this institution for taking such good care of me in the way that they did.
The words of a mentally retarded man before his execution. Yesterday, the Supreme Court declared that the Constitution bars the execution of the mentally retarded. We'll hear a rare recording of this man's last words. Then, he's called the People's Historian. Today, we spend much of the hour with historian, activist, playwright Howard Zinn.
Oh, thanks for having me, Amy. I admire Amy Goodman, one of the great journalists of our time. Maybe any time, maybe since the Roman Empire. What do you think?
Howard, you were supposed to say something about yourself. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court declared yesterday the Constitution bars the execution of the mentally retarded. The court ruled in favor of a Virginia prisoner, Darryl Renard Atkins, who was convicted and sentenced to death for a 1996 robbery and murder. According to Atkins' lawyers, he has an IQ of 59. The ruling applies to people with an IQ of 70 or lower. The decision comes at a time when two pro-death penalty governors have declared a moratorium on executions, and over 100 innocent people have been exonerated from death row. There are currently over 3,700 people on death row in the United States. Over the past decade and a half, 18 states have prohibited the execution of the mentally retarded. Georgia was one of the first two states to change its law after public outrage at the controversial execution of Jerome Bowden, a mentally disabled man. Bowden had an IQ of 59 at age 14 and an estimated IQ of 65 when he was executed at the age of 34. Here are the last words of Jerome Bowden, spoken before he was electrocuted in June of 1986. They are in the possession of Sound Portraits Productions, and they are from the death chamber immediately before Bowden's execution.
I am Jerome Bowden, and I would just like to state that my execution is about to be carried out. And I would like to thank the people at this institution for taking such good care of me in the way that they did. And I hope that by my execution being carried out, that it may bring some light to this thing that it is wrong. And I would like to have a final prayer with Chaplain LaVille, if that is possible. Thank you very much.
The final words of Jerome Bowden. Later in the program, Juan Gonzalez will speak with a prison chaplain who's ministered to many mentally disabled prisoners before they were executed, and you'll hear another comment that Mr. Bowden made just before he was killed by the state. U.S. and British warplanes on patrol in the southern no-fly zone in Iraq attacked civilian targets in southern Iraq Thursday, killing 4 civilians and wounding 10 others. This according to the official Iraqi news agency. The agency said the Allied warplanes attacked, quote, civilian public service installations about 370 kilometers south of Baghdad. The warplanes took off from Kuwait and flew a total of 44 sorties, and the Iraq military fired surface-to-air missiles and anti-aircraft guns in response, the agency said. The Israeli army sent tanks into Nablus and began calling up reserves for a new military operation after Palestinians raided a West Bank settlement, killing a mother, 3 of her sons, and a security official. 8 other people were wounded before Israeli troops stormed the house, killing 1 of the Palestinian gunmen. Meanwhile, Israeli forces fired on a market in the West Bank city of Jenin today, killing 2 children and a man and wounding dozens of other Palestinians. They mistakenly thought a curfew had been lifted. Also, Yasser Arafat appealed to Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade to halt attacks on Israeli civilians. The appeal comes after 2 suicide bombings over 2 days killed 26 Israelis and sent Israeli troops back into 4 West Bank towns. In Israel, there were growing divisions over Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's decision to seize Palestinian areas and occupy them indefinitely. Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer said he strongly opposed long-term reoccupation of Palestinian areas. Car bombs rocked two Spanish tourist resorts on Friday, injuring at least six people in attacks by suspected Basque separatists. The bombs were timed to coincide with a European Union summit in Seville. A bomb exploded shortly after a British banker started up his Land Rover in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, killing him Thursday outside a residential compound in the Saudi capital. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the bombing, but Saudi law enforcement officials have attributed similar attacks over the past few years to expatriates engaged in a turf war in the lucrative black market trade in liquor. Britain secured immunity from prosecution in the International Criminal Court for its troops in Afghanistan, this while criticizing the United States for its refusal to accept the tribunal. The New York governor, clearly concerned about the Latino vote in the fall election, met with New York mothers of the disappeared in Albany yesterday, offering them a bill that would potentially release their loved ones from prison, but would not overhaul the Rockefeller drug laws as they have demanded. Randy Credico, director of the Consular Fund for Racial Justice, was with the mothers of the disappeared in Albany and met with the governor. Randy, what is the latest as the legislation comes to a close in Albany? Will the Rockefeller drug laws be overturned?
It was dead yesterday, but it was revived by the mothers going up there, meeting with the governor and kind of sandbagging him. The Senate now is staying an extra week to try to deal with this issue. The governor met with the mothers and offered them something that would, you know, bribe them and divide the rest of the movement. And it would help out 0.01% of the population get out of prison. So New York, with the governor's plan, would go from having the worst drug laws in the nation to having the worst drug laws in the nation, and that has been stopped. We also gave the governor a copy of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, and we hope he reads it.
Among the ads the mothers have threatened to put in Latino newspapers are Pataki's kids go to Yale, our kids go to jail. And finally, two interesting reports on press censorship. Executives at CNN dismissed reports that CNN might be removed from the air in Israel, saying it retains strong relationships with Israel's satellite and cable distributors, at least partly in response to protests about CNN coverage from Israeli government officials and viewers. CNN adopted a formal policy to avoid the use of videotaped statements by Palestinian suicide bombers or their families. Ethan Jordan, the top news executive at CNN, flew to Israel for consultations with Israeli officials over covering the conflict. Also, CNN disavowed the comments of CNN founder Ted Turner, in which he equated Israeli military actions with the suicide bombers, saying, quote, "I would make the case that both sides are engaged in terrorism." Interestingly enough, Susanna Flood, a spokesperson for CNN International, said CNN received assurances from YES executives, the satellite company in Israel, that there would be no disruption in the service in Israel. But they did acknowledge that they are putting Fox News next to CNN on the satellite. So if people did not want to watch CNN, they could flip quickly to Fox. Israeli government officials said the addition of Fox News would surely attract some Israeli viewers who've questioned CNN's coverage because, quote, Fox will be seen as coming from the Israeli point of view. And lest people think censorship only occurs abroad, this news from Camden, New Jersey. Four Philadelphia Inquirer reporters were each fined $1,000, and three of them were given community service for a story in which they quoted one juror and identified another after the sensational trial of a rabbi charged with murder. The reporters were sentenced one to 180 days in jail, suspended as long as he serves 5 days of community service. Two were each given a suspended 180-day sentence, provided they serve 10 days of community service. They will be assigned to a work detail such as picking up trash through the county sheriff's labor assistance program, giving new meaning to the term muckraking.
The military salesman, he says peace doesn't pay. In search of enemies, he calls the CIA. One of our puppets just aims towing glide. So now it's killing time.
Peace Now, Andrew Thompson, a listener here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to our listeners around the country. Amy, you know, there's an interesting little tidbit in the latest Jet magazine, which Anthony Sloan reminds us is the Bible in some areas. A new Brookings Institution poll on trust in government shows that Secretary of State Colin Powell is more popular in the country than President George Bush by about 10 percentage points, which I guess goes to show you that a cautious and cerebral warmonger is always preferred to a loose-lipped, rash and one of limited intelligence.
Well, we're going to go beyond limited intelligence today with our next guest, Howard Zinn. He overturned the sacred myth of Christopher Columbus as a courageous hero. He unmasked military leaders like Andrew Jackson and Theodore Roosevelt as racists, war lovers, imperialists, and Indian killers. He revealed our most liberal presidents, Jefferson, Lincoln, FDR, Kennedy, is more concerned with political power and national might than the rights of non-white people. And he exposed the Cold War as a competition fueled by thirst for empire and domination. He rewrote history from the perspective of the people and in the process tore down heroes, giving us new ones in the process. The farmers of the Shays Rebellion, the black abolitionists, conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War, striking factory workers. I'm speaking of Howard Zinn, the great scholar, activist, teacher, author. No other historian has attacked the distortions and myths about the history of the United States as forcefully as he has. In book after book, he has stood the traditional great men approach to history on its head. He's shown that historical change occurs more through mass movements of ordinary people than through the wisdom and insight of world leaders. His groundbreaking book, A People's History of the United States, was one of the first major looks at American history from this perspective. It transformed the field of historical research, going through 25 printings and selling close to 500,000 copies. But Howard Zinn did not confine his revolutionary work to his scholarship. While he was overturning history, he was also making it, adding his voice to the movements for peace, civil rights, social justice, and equality. As a professor at Spelman College in the 1950s, he joined his students on the picket lines and at sit-ins, traveling through the South as a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He headed north to Boston in the 60s, to Boston University, took to the streets to protest the Vietnam War, was arrested numerous times for his anti-war actions, but he could not be silenced. He traveled to North Vietnam and Japan to speak out against U.S. policies, testified at some dozen trials on the importance of breaking unjust laws. Most recently, he has been an outspoken critic of the so-called war on terrorism. And this spring, he published the book Terrorism and War, a book exploring the loss of civil liberties during war and the history of American resistance to wars from World War I to the war in Afghanistan. And today, he graces us with his presence in our Firehouse studio here in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Howard Zinn.
Thanks, Amy. That's the best summary of my writing that I've ever heard. I mean, I couldn't do it.
Which is why we did it for you at the beginning
thanks.
Of the program. So you have been extremely active since September, going around the country.
I have, yeah.
Didn't you expect this to be your golden retirement years?
I never expected any golden retirement years, but I expected more leisure than I've had, you know, yeah, since September 11th. Yeah, I've been going nonstop. I, like a lot of us, have, because I guess we have felt that our voices are very badly needed at a time when they're trying to stifle voices of dissent. And so I can't say no when somebody invites me to Walla Walla, Washington, you know, or places, you know, all over the country, or high schools. I had this interesting experience. I don't know if you want to hear this, Amy, but, you know.
Well,
I'll tell
does.
You anyway. You know, and high schools are always interesting because, you know, when you speak to college audiences, you think, well, maybe, you know, a lot of liberal kids, or maybe they're more tuned, or maybe they've, you know, but high school students are more, I think, open in a sense that they're certainly not on my, they don't start out on my side. high school kids, I think, are a very militarized part of the population. You know, they're subject to military recruiters coming into the high schools, drumming up, you know, super patriotism, and you know, high school kids are seeing TV and movies or glorifying war and military heroism. And so I like to speak to high schools because, you know, they're the young people of the coming generation. I always wonder how they're going to react to what I say. I spoke at a high school in my community in the Boston area. It was the first invitation I'd had from a high school to speak to a student assembly. You know, hundreds of students assembled there. You know, when there's a student assembly in high school, they haven't volunteered to come. You know, high school is a... You know,
very little voluntary about it.
Yeah, no. High school is a very, a little like a police state. You know, but so there were these students, and hundreds of them. I spoke, of course, against the war, against the Bush's so-called war on terrorism, and spoke about the civilian casualties in Afghanistan, and spoke about the deceptions practiced on the American public, and I got this wonderful reception from the students, wonderful reception. Then a few parents made the local newspapers by protesting my appearance. Not only did they protest what I said, they protested the fact that I had been invited. They didn't think my voice should even be heard. You know, they learned a lot from Bush and Ashcroft, I guess. And that made the local newspaper because the local newspaper doesn't have much news. So this was a big thing. And was in a local newspaper for weeks. The result of this was I immediately got invitations from 7 other high schools in Massachusetts to speak, and I spoke to all of them. And in all of them, I got wonderful, positive receptions to my criticism of the war. So, yeah, so I've been doing a lot of this, and I'm encouraged by what I see because I feel that a lot of people are having second thoughts about this war. I feel that this, figure that they give out, 85% in support of Bush, is very misleading, and that the support for Bush is very thin, based on very little information, and that as soon as people begin to get a little bit of information, or as soon as a few questions are asked that make them think, that initial support disappears. So I'm hopeful about a sort of a growing understanding about what is going on.
Well, but speaking about this whole issue of attempting to squash dissent, and as a historian, how do you see the current climate here and the USA Patriot Act and the government's suspension of civil liberties compared to other periods, other wartime periods in American history?
Well, probably, there have always been dissent in American wars. I mean, even the American Revolution, which people think is, is a unanimous American opposition to England. There was dissent, there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army. There was dissent in the Mexican War, the desertions by soldiers in the Mexican War, criticism of the Mexican War. Of course, people like Thoreau and Emerson and soldiers who came back from the war. But probably the closest parallel to what we are seeing now in the attempt to dragoon the American population into support of the war to suppress dissent is probably World War I. What happened in World War I was, they passed legislation like the Patriot Act, They passed the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. And just as the Patriot Act doesn't have anything to do with patriotism, but has a lot to do with suppression of free speech, the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act had nothing to do with espionage. They had to do with people speaking out against the war. And they put 1,000 people in jail, prosecuted 2,000 people, put 1,000 people in jail, and rounded up towards the end of the war in a kind of a state of hysteria, actually, about what they called terrorism. One bomb had exploded. They rounded up thousands and thousands of non-citizens, and no, just like today, no due process, no constitutional rights, paraded them through the streets of cities, manacled to one another, and put them on board ship and sent them back to various countries in Europe. So, yeah, the World War I situation is one that comes closest to this really hysterical atmosphere that they're trying to create today.
And in terms of we have Americans, even in this situation, we have American citizens now, alleged yes, members of Al-Qaeda yeah. who are suddenly being disappeared, not allowed even yeah. Not even allowed even legal representation, and yet there's very little outcry from many Americans.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. Because I think so the press has been very complicit in maintaining silence about this and not playing up this horrendous fact that not only are non-citizens subject to, you know, these illegal detentions and interrogations and violations of due process, but now, yes, American citizens. And on what basis? When you examine the evidence that they, you know, have produced against this American citizen who is supposed to have plotted, you know, a dirty bomb, and all you have to do is put things like that in the headlines, dirty bomb, you know. As
opposed
know, the,
to a clean bomb.
The United States has always used clean bombs, yes. And the United States hasn't just, you know, planned to use bombs. They've used them. But this guy, they don't even know what he did. They can't produce any evidence, but they're detaining him, and he doesn't have any rights, and so on. Now, my hope is that when people become aware of this, that they will see that the what they may have accepted at first, and that is okay, it's okay to detain non-citizens, you know, aliens. I like that word alien because it immediately separates these non-citizens from the rest of the population. But maybe people will understand that what has been done, what is being done to non-citizens can also be done to American citizens, that every one of us is subject to the kind of Gestapo treatment. I know that sounds like harsh language, but, you know, I think it's accurate, really. I mean, that's what they did. They rounded up people, you know, without charges and just, you know, put them away. And my hope is that more and more people will realize that all of us are subject to that.
We're talking to historian Howard Zinn. Among his books, or his latest, Terrorism and War. We'll be back with him in a minute.
So there's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda. That's a huge industry. In fact, it extends over the, obviously, the commercial media, but the whole range of systems that reach the public, the entertainment industry, television, a good bit of what appears in schools, a lot of what appears straight out in the newspapers and so on. A huge amount of that comes straight out of the public relations industry, which was established in this country early in the century and sort of developed mainly in the 20s and on. That has become an enormous industry. It's now spreading over the rest of the world, but it's primarily here. And its goal from the beginning, perfectly openly and consciously, was to control the public mind, as they put it. And the reason was that the public mind was seen as the greatest threat to corporations. That's from early in the century. Business power was strong.
Meta-historical disquisition from Paranoise, featuring Noam Chomsky, a close friend of our guest today, Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States and many other books. His autobiography, Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. His latest is Terrorism and War. Paranoia's Noam Chomsky. You're neighbors, aren't you?
Well, we live in the same environment in the Boston area. And in the summer, in those rare moments when Noam takes time off and I take time off, we are even closer neighbors on Cape Cod, you know. I shouldn't tell people that Noam ever spends time on Cape Cod because it will ruin his reputation as a person who spends 24 hours a day fighting the establishment. But he takes a few minutes off.
I wanted to go back, even before this book, Terrorism and War, before your autobiography, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, to a people's history that has had such an impact, not only in this country but around the world, as you documented people's movements that shape history. How did you start that book? What made you decide to write this, and how hard was it to do?
Well, I'd like to say it was really hard to do, so people will feel sorry for me. But How did I came to do it? I suppose simply because I had studied history and you know up through graduate school, Columbia University, and so on, and I realized, as a result of my own life experiences, you know, that the history books were not telling stories that were very, very important in the American past. You know, I my first experience teaching was in a black college in Atlanta, Georgia, and black history was given a quick nod. You know, it's a few, a little bit on Frederick Douglass and so on.
This was Spelman.
And this was Spelman College in Atlanta, yeah. And that was an important experience for me, spending 7 years in the South and beginning to look at history from a black point of view. And if you look at history from a black point of view, everything looks different. The Constitution suddenly is not that marvelous document that Ronald Reagan praised, you know, said was written with the helping hand of God and so on. And you learn a lot about the so-called heroes in American history who, when looked at from a point of view of African Americans, were not heroes at all. Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, who looked the other way when black people were killed by the hundreds in the South. So I learned a lot about looking at history from a different point of view. And I was aware, and I had grown up in working class family, working class neighborhood, went to work in a shipyard at the age of 18. I grew up with a kind of class consciousness, and I was aware that the history textbooks had virtually nothing on the great American labor struggles, the working class to win the 8-hour day, to change their conditions. And the result of that is you got the impression that benefits workers had received, you know, like Social Security or minimum wage or the 8-hour day came as a result of the kindness of Congress or of benevolent presidents instead of from the struggles of working people who faced off armies and National Guardsmen and police and went to jail and were killed. And so with this kind of a background understanding, and also being in a war, you know, I was a bombardier in World War II, and came away from that and this was the good war, and I came away from the good war with a feeling that war doesn't solve any fundamental problems. You know, it may seem to, seem to solve something quickly and immediately, but very soon you realize that all those things the war was supposed to do away with, racism and fascism, were not done away with it. So all these experiences, which I didn't find represented in the point of view of the history I was learning, the history books, led me to write a People's History of the United States. And I knew immediately, you know, and this sense it was easy in the sense that once you know, when you write a book, once you know what your point of view is, it's a lot easier, you know, to write. I knew that when I was going to deal with Columbus, I was not going to deal with Columbus from the point of view of the Spanish or from the point of view of Columbus himself, but from the point of view of his victims and so on. You know, I was going to look at the Mexican War from the standpoint of the deserting soldiers and not from the generals. Well, we'll look at it from the standpoint of the Mexicans who lost half their country as a result of this expansionist war, you know. I was led to really write the book as a result of my own experiences.
Did you expect it to have the kind of response that it did, close to 500,000 books?
Amy, I never like to correct you, you know, publicly, you know, like before.
Millions.
A radio audience. It's now sold 1 million copies, you see, and which is, I must say, in all modesty, right, remarkable for, you know, any book on history. It's not a textbook. Textbooks very often sell a lot of copies because people are forced to buy them, but it's not a textbook. So people buy this, you know, voluntarily. And so it sold them. And this, you know, did I expect this? No. Did my publisher expect it? No. Did my editor? No, none of us expected it. And so when I try to explain it, well, I think what it means is that there are, yes, millions of people in this country who want a different kind of history. Millions of people in this country who have some suspicion that they have not been getting the truth in the educational system, from the media, from our officials, and they are looking for a point of view which represents them, which represents working people and people of color and women, and that's the only thing that explains why so many people, you know, have bought this book.
Well, interestingly, given the book's radical perspective, of course, many people were surprised a couple of years back, I think, when we heard the news that Fox, I think, was interested in creating a television dramatization of the book. Of course, Murdoch, who runs Fox, is considered the Darth Vader of corporate media. And what's happened with that endeavor, or has it gone anywhere?
Darth Vader finally found out about the project. You know, it's a great empire. Yeah. Well, I don't really know what happened. You never know what happens, you know, behind the scenes. All I know is that after a couple of years of fooling with the project, you know, they're going to produce dramatized episodes, and Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and I and Chris Moore, we're going to be the executive producers and so on and so forth. And after a couple of years of fooling around with it, Fox dropped it. But HBO picked it up, and right now, I mean, HBO is, I guess, more daring because they don't have to pay attention to advertisers. They don't have commercials. And so HBO now, we have a contract with HBO. HBO has hired two writers to write the first two scripts, one about the, you know, these are not documentaries. These are feature films. The first one on about Columbus, Las Casas, and second one on the American Revolution. Very different view on the American Revolution than in Mel Gibson's The Patriots, you know. And so these two writers are working now on these scripts, and who knows if something might happen. You know, with Hollywood, you never know.
Well, we do know something about Hollywood. These big blockbusters recently, Black Hawk Down, Pentagon investing millions in it, also Some of All Fears, Pentagon giving over military equipment, military advisors, and of course, I mean, in the case of Black Hawk Down, for example, that I can't really say documents the U.S. invasion of Somalia, because that makes it sound like it was true how they depicted it. But the Mark Bowden, who is the Philadelphia Inquirer writer of the book, said that the Pentagon, yes, had to approve the transcript in order to be willing to invest all this money, and changed it where they didn't like it. What about this Hollywood-Pentagon relationship?
Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, it goes back to the Vietnam War. You know, with the Green Berets, you know, where the movie producers go back and forth to the Pentagon to produce a film that will, you know, glorify the Green Berets and the American involvement in Vietnam. And, you know, the media have, the television, the movies, you know, have always been pitifully timid and obsequious, and I like the word obsequious, in relation to the government and the Pentagon. Black Hawk Down is an example of it. I mean, my son saw Black Hawk Down. I couldn't bring myself to see it, and I asked him what it was about, and he told me what it was about. And it was obvious, you know, I've read a lot about it, and obvious that what Black Hawk Down did was to portray the American soldiers as victims. You know, there was the famous picture of the American Ranger being dragged through the streets, you know, and Somalia and so on. But if you read about what happened in Somalia, which I've done, you know, you find out that the anger of the Somalis was caused by something that they don't tell about in Black Hawk Down, and that is a few months before these American soldiers were killed. I mean, 19 or so Rangers killed, 1,000 or 2,000 Somalis killed, but before that happened, several months before, the Americans had committed an atrocity in Somalia. They had barged into a building where a group of elders were meeting and just fired away, just killed everybody in sight, you know. And the Somalis didn't forget this. That part of the history is ignored. And so, you know, what Black Hawk Down is a typical example of what Hollywood and the government collaborate to do to build up this pro-war sentiment and the idea that, you know, the Americans are the good guys. I mean, we're there in another country, invading another country, and we're the good guys.
Well, as a veteran of as you say, the good war, and it's gotten increasing attention, obviously, from network anchors who have been making a lot of money off of World War II these days. In your book, Terrorism and War, you talk about your change of view about war, that you did at one point believe there were just wars and unjust wars, and as time has developed, you've had your thoughts on that have evolved. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I volunteered for the Air Force in World War II, became a bombardier, dropped bombs on Europe. I was an enthusiastic bombardier, and it seemed very simple. They were the bad guys, we were the good guys. And I came out of that sort of having learned a lot about the psychology of war and warriors. You know, one element is that once you decide that they are the bad guys and you are the good guys, you make two judgments which on later reflection turn out to be, you know, very, very dangerous. One is the idea that if they're the bad guys, you must be good. But of course that isn't so. They could be bad and you could be bad. They could be worse and you are still bad. I mean, after all, World War II was fought against the worst, the fascist powers. But the people who fought against the fascist powers, who were they? They were the imperialist powers of the West, of the United States and France, and there was the dictatorship of the Soviet Union, you know. And so, no, the fact that they are bad doesn't mean you're good, you know. And the second thing is that although you may start off looking like the good guys, fighting a good cause, as we did in World War II, but war corrupts everybody. War turns people with a good cause into people who commit atrocities. And so, of course, the Germans committed horrendous atrocities in World War II. But soon, the United States and England, which had denounced Hitler for bombing civilians, soon the United States and England were bombing civilians deliberately. I mean, this was a deliberate decision on the part of Churchill and his advisors, and Arthur Harris, in command of the bombers, and with the compliance of the Americans, Curtis LeMay and others, a deliberate decision to bomb the working class districts of German cities. And so we kill 100,000 people in Dresden in one night, 50,000, 60,000 in Hamburg and Frankfurt, and then, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, I mean, these are atrocities. And so we become corrupted by war. So I came out of World War II still feeling, so fascism was terrible. Something had to be done about fascism, but not in the way that we did it. And not in a way which, in fact, doesn't end fascism, doesn't end racism. Hitler was gone, Mussolini was gone, Japanese military machine was gone. Fascism was still there. Imperialism was still there. The United States and the Soviet Union were now building up nuclear arsenals, which, if used, would make the Hitler's Holocaust look puny. So World War II had to be re-examined, you see. And now I believe that today a just war is impossible, simply for this reason. War inevitably is the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people. No matter what they say about, limited warfare, smart bombs, we only bomb military targets, we have enough history of those statements to know that they are lies, really. War is the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people, which means, really, if you think about it, that war is the killing of children, inevitably. War is always a war against children. So whatever the cause, the good cause, somebody invaded somebody, Iraq invaded Kuwait, Milosevic is, doing bad things, really evil things. Whatever the cause, if you react to it with war, you are then in the business of committing more and more atrocities. You are in the business of matching the horrors that you are supposedly fighting against. To put it another way, in war, the means, that is, bombing and so on, the means of war are always certain and immediate. The ends of war, freeing somebody, getting rid of some tyrant, the ends of war are always uncertain and far off. And therefore, from a moral point of view, war can no longer be just. And the human race had better figure out ways to solve problems in the world without war.
Howard Zinn is our guest. How old are you now?
You know, why do journalists always ask that question? But I'm going to be 80. I should, you know, I shouldn't say that. I should say I'm only 79.
When will you be 80?
When will I be 80? In August. Yeah. Are you coming?
I hope so. 80 years old.
Yeah.
So you were born in 1922.
Born in the 19th century. I was born in 1922. Yeah. Harding was president, one of my favorite presidents.
Why?
I'm half serious. Half serious. Harding, if you study American history, the tradition is, oh, Wilson was the good guy. Wilson was a liberal. Harding was the conservative. Wilson put Eugene Debs, the socialist leader, in jail. Harding pardoned him, you see. So I have a soft spot in my heart for Harding.
He ran for president from jail.
He ran for president from jail, yeah. Yeah.
Wilson got as many votes as got people who bought your book.
Yeah.
Wilson championed self-determination, then invaded half of Latin America.
That's right, yeah.
So in this 80 years, do you feel like things are getting better?
Yes and no. How's that for a straight answer? Some things are worse, definitely worse. There are nuclear bombs, nuclear weapons. And people prepared to use them, and absolute idiots in charge of these nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union, in Russia, in India, in Pakistan. I mean, this is a worse time in terms of the possibilities of the destruction of the human race, worse time than we've ever had, worse time in terms of the environment. You know, the technology of our time, the so-called progress that we've made has only resulted in an enormous pollution of the air and water and the warming of all of that. Some things definitely worse. On the other hand, I'm always looking for something. On the other hand, I do believe that there is a gradual learning that takes place, that there's an awareness of certain things that people weren't even aware of before. And even though that awareness has not yet been turned into action and change, the awareness is there under the surface. For instance, I think there's an awareness now of the issue of race in the way. I mean, race, it just wasn't, Ralph Ellison wrote The Invisible Man. You know, blacks were invisible. We still have racism. But blacks are no longer invisible. The issue of racism is no longer invisible. People have to think about it. The issue of women's equality today is there. It's on the agenda. I mean, it was simply not talked about. The rights of gays and lesbians, I mean, it was unmentionable 30 years ago. And now it's in the culture. And what I'm saying that, even though we have not succeeded in changing policy, even though they're terrible people in power and threatening to use their power over everybody. And I do believe that under the surface of that control, there is a gradual sort of bubbling of awareness, which I hope one of these days, if people continue to learn and act and resist, that will turn into some great social movement that will bring about change. I'm hopeful about that. It's a possibility, not a certainty. Nothing is certain.
And do you think, in terms of president, if you can call him President Bush right now, a man not popularly elected president who's declared war on the world, where do you see him going? And the issue of the election that he took and the wars that he's waging.
Well, Bush, what can I say about Bush? I can't watch him. You know, I listened to his State of the Union address only because I was forced to, because some radio station said, will you comment on it? So I had to Maybe you did. You, it was you who forced me to this torture of listening to Bush's State of the Union address, really. You know, and
at least he had a script there.
Yeah. You know, I read recently where Bush was talking to the president of Brazil, and he said to the president of Brazil, do you have any blacks here in Brazil?
Condoleezza Rice had to jump right in and salvage him.
But his ignorance is not the most serious thing. I'm not worried about people not knowing facts and not knowing things. That's okay. That can be corrected. You could send Bush to a Quaker school, you know, and educate him. Problem is not ignorance. And the problem is morality. The problem is who he's connected to. The problem is his connection to very wealthy corporations and the oil interests. And his viciousness. I mean, after all, let's not forget, he was the governor of Texas when they executed more people. You were just talking before about executions. Execution of more people than anybody else. And of course, it's not just Bush. It's all the people around him. It's that whole, I very often feel we're in an occupied country. It's like we're in World War II, and we're Czechoslovakia, we're Norway. You know, we've been occupied by an alien power, really. I feel that way. And we need to build up a resistance against this. That's how I feel about Bush and all those people up there.
Well, Howard Zinn, I want to thank you very much for joining us, People's Historian. His latest book is Terrorism and War. It's published by Seven Stories Press here in New York. I know tomorrow night, Saturday, you'll be at Seven Stories Press at 140 Watts Street for a party. Celebrating this book, but also your many years of activism and scholarship. And speaking of the death penalty, I actually have to head off right now to catch a plane to go to the Pacifica board meeting in Berkeley, California, celebrating the new Pacifica. But Juan, you're going to go back to the beginning of this show with some very rare recording of a man who was executed, who was mentally retarded, his last words in this landmark decision of the Supreme Court on Thursday that says the Constitution bars the execution of the mentally retarded. You are listening to Democracy Now. Back in a minute.
If we would care enough to make a change, you know we'd live in love and bleed.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! That was The World We Live In, and the group was Cleopatra. A divided Supreme Court reversed course on Thursday and ruled that executing mentally retarded people is unconstitutionally cruel, giving scores of inmates on death row the possibility of a reprieve. The court ruled in favor of a Virginia inmate, Darryl Renard Atkins, who was convicted and sentenced to death for 1996 robbery and murder. According to Atkins' lawyer, he has an IQ of 59. The ruling applies to people with an IQ of 70 or lower. The decision comes at a time when two pro-death penalty governors have declared a moratorium on executions and over 100 innocent people have been exonerated from death row. There are currently over 3,700 people on death row in the United States. Over the past decade and a half, 18 states have prohibited the execution of the mentally retarded. Georgia was one of the first two states to change its law after public outrage at the controversial execution of Jerome Bowdoin, a mentally disabled man. Bowdoin had an IQ of 59 at age 14 and an estimated IQ of 65 when he was executed at the age of 34. Earlier in the program, we heard the last words of Jerome Bowdoin, a mentally disabled man who was electrocuted in June 1986. He was found guilty of the burglary, armed robbery, aggravated assault, and murder of two women for whom he was doing yard work. Before he was electrocuted, he gave a final statement from his death cell. His words are recorded by Sound Portraits Production as part of their project, The Execution Tapes.
And the statement that I would like to make is first, I would like to thank the Lord for giving me the opportunity to make this statement. And I thank the Lord for the chaplain and for all the people at this administration that he has placed into work here. And if my execution is carried out, I know that it will be done through by the Lord's will. And I just want the people to know that I am not the same person that I was once upon a time, because I was baptized here in 1980. And the old creature was destroyed, and I became a new creature. And I would just like to just ask that people remember me as the Christian, and that not as the old Jerome Bowdoin, because the old Jerome Bowdoin is no more. The new Jerome Bowdoin is here, and when he is passed away, he will be remembered as the Christian Jerome Bowdoin. And I would just like to thank all the people out in the world that have fought so hard to preserve my life, and I'm not giving up. I might give out, but I cannot give up, because I know that the Lord is still here with me, no matter what may happen. And I would just like to thank the whole entire world and the people that's in the world, and also the fine people at this administration that I have had the opportunity to come in contact with the time that I have been here, including Chaplain LaVille. And I would just like to say that I'm thankful that Mr. Marable and all his administration has done whatever they could do to make this thing much more easier for me to deal with, because it is a very hard thing to deal with, and I know it, and they know it. So that's why that they are still standing close by to make sure that everything goes according to plan. And I would like to thank him for placing a correctional officer here that has stayed with me from the time this thing started until now. And with this last statement, I would just like to close out and say, God bless Mr. Marable and all the administration.
The last words of Jerome Bowdoin before he was executed in June of 1986. We're joined now by the Reverend Carol Pickett, who was death chaplain at the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas, for 16 years. He was chaplain for 95 executions and counseled some mentally retarded people before they were put to death. He joins us by telephone. Welcome, Reverend Pickett.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences as a chaplain there at Huntsville, especially with some of the mentally retarded inmates that you dealt with?
Well, when I first started there, we weren't doing executions, but we had the mentally retarded inmates on our unit, so I dealt with those who weren't committed to die. But then in 1982, we began to execute people. We were the first country, state, nation in the world to do lethal injection. And I was with the first 95 that died by lethal injection. And many of those were mentally retarded, mentally challenged, whatever you want to call it. And there were, I'd say at least 20 of those 95 did not understand what was going on.
In terms of your work with them, what did you attempt to do?
My main responsibility, according to the warden, was to be with them all day and be their, I guess, their last friend, he called it, and talk to them and explain everything to them so they wouldn't fight coming out of the cell, they wouldn't fight getting up on the field. But with those people, with those who are mentally retarded or mentally challenged, it was mainly just listening to what they'd talk about, you know, all afternoon and all night, particularly the last 2 hours. And one of my plans, and which I did on all of them, is that I would explain to them at 10 o'clock at night, just 2 hours before they died, what was going to take place, you know, how the needles were going to go in and everything. And some of them never understood what I was talking about. They did not know. They could not comprehend that this was going to kill them. This, they did not know. They would get, I would get through explaining to them, and then they would say, okay, now when do I go back out to death row? They just didn't understand.
And what were your feelings about that, and your reaction now to the Supreme Court decision yesterday?
Well, I think it's great. I think the Supreme Court finally did something right. They did it wrong several years ago. Here in Texas, our legislature last year voted to not execute the mentally ill, and our governor vetoed it. And they were representing the people. The people said to our legislators, let's don't do this. You know, these kids, people who've been in prison since they were 17 or committed their crimes when they were 17, or some that just did not remember the crime at all. And our people, and we don't have polls that are accurate, but they had contacted their legislators, and the legislatures, both houses here in Texas, voted to pass a resolution to ask to stop executing the mentally ill. And they did. And then the governor vetoed it. But I'm glad that the Supreme Court did. They reversed themselves from several years ago, because these people do not understand that the law says they must understand what is happening to them. I know that in 1995, even Ted Koppel came down and witnessed an execution, and he was amazed to see that Mario did not comprehend what was taking place. And he visited with him, and he heard his last words, and he watched him die. So I hope they will keep it this way.
And your feelings
go further.
And your feelings about the death penalty in general, having witnessed so many.
Of course, I've changed completely. I used to be for it, but I'm totally opposed to it now. It's not deterring crime anymore, like they claim it has. Like in Houston, more people are executed from Houston than from anywhere here in Texas. And the first week of June, there were 16 murders in Houston. 16 murders, biggest weekend, worst weekend they've ever had. It's not a deterrent, and we're just killing. We're killing people, and they put them in prison for years. And by the time they get around to killing them, they're not the same person.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us, the Reverend Carol Pickett, who was death chaplain at the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas for 16 years. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Michael Yeh. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org, and you can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
The moon and stars will take off.